New Year to everybody. So the last time we discussed, we finished with discussing the Chandrasekhar limiting mass, and today we continue discussing the Chandrasekhar limiting mass and looking at some detailed numerical values in solving the Lane-Emden equation. So, just as a repetition, we have been looking at the Lane-Emden equation. Which states that 1 over psi squared d over d psi of psi squared d theta over d psi is equal minus theta to the power of n. Okay, where psi was the radius over some characteristic radius. And theta was the ratio of the density to some power. Actually, theta to the power of n is identical to rho over some characteristic density, and this density is actually the density in the core of the sphere we're looking at. And n was the polytropic index. So we could classify the solutions in terms of this polytropic index, and there are three known analytic solutions. Unfortunately, the analytic solutions are not the ones which you really want to have, because we are mainly interested in other polytropic indices. So let's make the connection to gamma again. So gamma, which we had before, is 1 plus 1 over n. And then the polytrope was given as following, that the pressure is a constant times rho to the power of gamma. I put here prime. Okay, so, good. So n equals 0, 1, and 5. We had analytic solutions. However, if you want to look at gamma equal 5/3, then n is equal, let's look at 5/3. 5/3 minus 1 is 2/3, it's 3/2. So n is 3/2. For that, we don't know the analytic solutions, and this is n equals 3. And for this, we need numerical values. Yeah, and numerical values. So what we have is, what the solution is basically how theta goes as a function of n, right? That's the solution. So theta as a function of psi. And that can have different profiles. So we start with some central value, which actually is 1. And then at the surface of the star, where psi is psi n, or the radius of the star, is clear. So this is theta, this is 1, and then somehow it goes down to this one. And we need actually two values. We need actually xi n is the radius of the sphere, which is and we need theta prime at xi equal xi n. And this is the derivative at the radius. And it turns out that actually by solving the differential equation, it's actually convenient to write everything in terms of xi n squared times theta prime, because this is just what appears here in this brackets here. So we can express the total mass by integrating over the mass density over the sphere, and by doing that we get an expression for the mass, total mass, which was the total mass. Yeah, so m is equal 4 pi dr r squared rho of r from 0 to capital R, yeah, where the capital R corresponds now to the dimensionful quantity where we have the radius of the sphere, and that is given as minus 4 pi k prime n plus 1 divided by 4 pi g to the power of 3/2 times xi n squared theta prime at the radius xi n times rho c to the power of 3 minus n divided by 2n. So in order to know the radius of the star, we need xi n. And in order to compute actually the total mass, we need the numerical prefactor xi n squared times theta prime at xi equal xi n. Now these are the two numerical coefficients we need. And I think I've written it down the last time, so that when n is 3/2 or 3, we have the following table. This is 3.65375. This is 2.71406, and this is 6.89685, and this is 2.01824. Okay? Numerical solutions. And these values have already been known 100 years ago. So without the advent of computers, people did calculate those coefficients just by hand. Well known. So at the time when Chandrasekhar wrote down the solution to the Leighton-Emden equation, he had those tables and those numerical coefficients with him, and could exactly compute the numerical value of the limiting mass. Right, we see that n equal 3 is a special case. For n equal 3,
this is the only case where the dependence on the central density drops out of the expression. So n equals 3 is special. M independent on rho c, and this is the Chandrasekhar limiting mass. Yeah, we can write this down. So we can plug in now what is k prime. We use the polytropic equation of state. We know for an electron gas immersed with a nuclei with a certain mass number A and charge set. And then the Chandrasekhar limiting mass is given by minus the square root of 3 pi over 2 C psi 3 squared theta prime of psi 3 times C over A times the mass of the nucleon squared. And here we get an H bar C over G to the 3/2, finally. Now we haven't put in the numerical values yet, so we have to do this. So here we put in now this value here, 2.018824. We just put in here, and then we get a numerical value, which is 1.456 solar masses. And we put in here a 2 set over A squared. This remains. And this is given in terms of the atomic mass unit mu over the mass per nucleon of the nucleus with the mass number A squared. Yeah, so it goes like 1 over the mass squared of the nucleus. So this is a convenient astrophysical notation, right? So if you plug in typical numbers, you get this prefactor, but you can immediately also tell the dependence on the other quantities. So if I change the mass-to-charge ratio of the nucleus, I can immediately calculate myself what is then the value of the maximum mass for other values. Also, if I change the binding energy of the nucleus, this will change basically the mass per nucleus in atomic mass units. But this is a small effect, right? The binding energy is below a percent, is a per mil effect. So the binding energy is not essential in changing the maximum mass of a white dwarf. However, there is a strong dependence on the charge to mass ratio. There's a strong dependence on the charge to mass ratio that, let's see, so let's consider different nuclei. So we have a charge to mass ratio of 1/2. We have actually for helium, we have this for carbon, oxygen, the stable one, oxygen 16. Carbon 12, helium 4, they all have a charge to mass ratio of 1/2. So there's basically the same amount of protons and neutrons in those nuclei. And the heavier ones, what else do we have? Calcium 40, for example, also. But however, most white dwarfs, when you look at stellar evolution, they stop basically at oxygen. So either we have helium white dwarfs or we have carbon-oxygen white dwarfs. So that's fine. The difference comes in if I have now, for example, iron 56. This is different. This has a C over A, which is
26 over 56.
So there's a slight, they are slightly neutron rich. There are slightly more neutrons than protons, so this ratio is 0.464, thereabout. So this looks like it's a 10% effect, but the 10% effect is much more than a per mil effect we had for the binding energy, and it goes with a square, so it's actually a 20% effect. So we see that the maximum mass goes down for a white dwarf. So if we look at the Chandrasekhar mass for iron 56, then the maximum mass is 1.258 solar mass, where I included also differences coming from the binding energy of iron 56 in the mass formula over there. So this will also change the mass radius relation for white dwarfs. So from the mass radius relation, we can infer the composition of a white dwarf. So if you measure the mass and the radius of a white dwarf and compare with the prediction we have for a certain mass to charge ratio, we can infer whether it is of this type or of this type. There have been a few mass radius measurements, not many, and they all somehow are compatible with a helium or carbon oxygen white dwarf. So iron white dwarf has not been found yet, unambiguously. There have been some claims in the literature, but later detailed studies showed that there was an erroneous measurement, or the so they had to change the mass or the radius of those white dwarfs so that they finally turn out to be compatible with an ordinary white dwarf. Right, so from the second remark is, of course, that these are idealized equations of state. So here we just assume we have a polytrope, right? We ignore several other effects which are inside a white dwarf, which will change the mass radius relation. And one of those we will discuss now in the following. Are there any questions to the Chandrasekhar limiting mass? So let's, as a final plot, let's draw the mass radius diagram for white dwarf. So we have, first we have, it actually goes like this, and then reaches the maximum mass. If I take this polytropes, actually it goes like this, right? So we have, here we have this gamma equal 5/3. And here we have then gamma equal 4/3. We reach the limit if we do a full calculation of a white dwarf. And this would be for C over A being 1/2. And then we get a smaller value. You would get a smaller value then for C over A equal 1.46. What is this for? We would get a smaller one. But the measurements somehow are compatible with this mass radius relation. Yeah. They have the same radius. The radius does not change. The radius is given by this numerical factor. Doesn't change, really. There are slight changes from the characteristic radius, but not much. And the most dramatic effect is in the maximum mass, which goes down. So, corrections. And what kind of corrections can we consider for our polytropic equation of state? the next we consider is lattice effects. We know somehow that we have nuclei and we have a bath of electrons, which makes the whole star charge neutral. And the most energetically favored configuration is, of course, if we order the nuclei so that they minimize Coulomb forces, so they repel each other, and they form an orderly lattice. So we have to discuss Coulomb corrections. Form a lattice. This minimizes the Coulomb energy. So what we're going to do in the following, we look at one singular cell. And we approximate the singular cell by a sphere. By a sphere. Yeah. So normally, if you have a lattice, you look at the nearest neighbors, and they might be located some distance away from your nucleus, and then you make cuts and take the half of the distance to the neighboring nuclei, and then you form a correspondingly three-dimensional hexagon or a multigon, and that you say, okay, I just have a nucleus here, and then I have a sphere with a radius r. So this is here the nucleus with given mass number A and charge Z. And then here I have the radius R of a sphere. And I have the electrons around the nucleus. So here I have electrons. And of course I have Z electrons, which make the whole thing charge neutral. And that object is called a weakness-side cell. Yeah, that's the approximation. So, number of electrons. So number of electrons, of course, should balance the charge of the nucleus, so it should be Z. And the number of electrons is just one integrates over the whole sphere times the number density of the electrons. And that radius I call R0, because later on we want to integrate over R. Okay, so NE is electron density, electron number density. So now we calculate the energy contribution of the whole cell. So one contribution comes from the electrons, and the other one comes from the nucleus itself, or from the lattice. So electrons first. Coulomb
energy of electrons. So we integrate over the charge Q. Q over R is the potential, and we integrate over the whole sphere from 0 to R0. Okay. And we say the charge we have within the sphere is given by set E, and it goes with the cube of the radius. Yeah, that's the charge within the sphere of radius R. And if R is R0, we get a total charge. Yeah, so we plug this one in. So this is we get an R squared, and we integrate over it, and then plug in the numbers, and this is just the ordinary answer we get for a uniformly charged sphere. So this is 3 over 5 Z squared E squared over R0. That's the final answer. So then we need a contribution from the ion or the nucleus. So we integrate that charge dQ over 1 over R, and it gives a minus 3/2 Z squared E squared over R0. We get a logarithm here, and by inverting that, we find actually that it gives a minus sign in total. And it has to be a minus sign because that charge has to balance the other charge above. All right, so in principle, so here we put in basically the charge is equal now Z times E. Here we put in the charge of the electrons. Here we put in the charge of the ion. So we get the ion contribution from the ion, the ion electron contribution. And now we look at the sum of the two contributions. E is then E of the electrons plus the contribution from the ion. Total. And we see both goes like 1 over R0. And the total value is minus 9 over 10 C squared E squared over R0. That's a simplified calculation, but it turns out it's very close to the real answer. One can do a numerical study of the total energy of the weakness side cell, and do this for a body-centered cubic lattice, a BCC lattice. One finds that instead of the prefactor is not 0.9, but is, where's the number? 0.909, 0.90981.
so close to the simple estimate we did above, right? Okay, so this energy contribution has to put in into the expression for the total energy. Basically, we get an additional contribution to the energy density. This, in principle, is now not only the mass density, but we get an additional contribution from the lattice energy, which needs to be included here. And the R0, how do we get the R0, the weakness side cell's radius? This we get by minimizing the total energy. So we're making different assumptions on R0 and then minimize the whole thing. We can also calculate the contribution to the energy per electron. So let's look at the Coulomb energy per electron set. This is minus 9/10 C of 2/3. E squared. And then for the radius, we use now this expression here to compute the radius in terms of the number density. And by that, we get a factor of a set to the 1/3. That's why we have a set to the 2/3 here. So this goes like 4 pi over 3, the number density of the electrons to the 1/3. Yeah, because this goes like 1 over R0, and 1 over R0 goes proportional to Ne to the 1/3. So it has to go like Ne to the 1/3, and the set to the 1/3 cancels this one, so this goes like set to the 2/3. But this looks very much like a polytrope. So we have here, we have the energy, here we have the number density, and we can replace the number density of electrons with the mass density of the nucleon, as we did before. And we see actually then that this is a polytrope with a certain power. So we need to compute now the power of this polytrope. And I need some space to do this. So we can calculate the corresponding pressure to this energy density by using thermodynamic relations. So this was the N squared dE Coulomb per electron over dN. E, this was one of the thermodynamic relations we derived before. Right here we have the energy in terms of the number density. So this is really a thermodynamic potential. We can calculate the pressure by using this relation here. And this gives us a minus 3/10 C to the 2/3 E squared times 4 pi over 3 N to the 1/3 times the number density of the electrons to the 4/3. Right, so we take the derivative with respect to Ne. This gives a minus 2/3 plus 2 So this gives a 4/3. Yeah. So this is a polytrope. With gamma equal 4/3. But we notice also there's a minus sign. The pressure is negative. And also the energy is negative. So this really doesn't really describe a stable bulk matter. It's just a contribution. So having this alone doesn't really make doesn't really work. So we need some additional contribution really to stabilize matter. So we have negative pressure, negative energy density. So we need some additional contribution. But we can also, even if both are negative, we can still write down that the contribution of the pressure is just 1/3 times the energy density. This you can derive by looking at the two equations we have written down here for the energy or energy density and the pressure. So it actually fulfills that relation. So it looks like a highly relativistic gas of electrons, but with negative signs on both sides. Very amusing. How large is this contribution? So we compare to a relativistic gas of electrons, that contribution. And we know for a relativistic gas of electrons, this also goes like Ne to the 4/3. So we have to compare the prefactor we have here for the Coulomb lattice to the one we have for a relativistic gas of particles. And the factor which is different is actually just this prefactor here. This is new. This doesn't appear for a gas of electrons. So the difference is it goes like C to the 2/3 E squared. Now, E squared in natural units is nothing else than the sum than the fine structure constant, alpha times C to the 2/3. Alpha is the fine structure constant. So in natural units, so alpha is E squared over h bar c. This would be the full expression for the fine structure constant. In natural units, h bar and c is 1, so alpha is equal E squared in our notation. And we know the value of the fine structure constant. What's the value of alpha? So alpha is about 1 over 137. Fine structure constant, so it's suppressed by 2 orders of magnitude, but enhanced by the charge to the 2/3. So alpha times C 2/3 is equal. We can compute it for helium. It's actually 0.01. this is for helium, and it's 0.03 for oxygen. Yeah, we don't consider heavier ones. Normally, we have helium white dwarfs or carbon oxygen white dwarfs. So this is a percent effect. So this is small. So the lattice does not change the maximum mass of a white dwarf. Yeah. However, it wins at low densities. At low densities, density, this goes with the power of 4/3. At low densities, electron gas goes like n to the 5/3. So eventually, the Coulomb will win compared to the Fermi gas. And what is going to happen then? Any idea? If the lattice wins compared to the Fermi pressure? Right, so there's a critical number density where the pressure of the lattice turns out to be larger than the pressure from the Fermi gas. So suddenly the pressure turns negative. So the white dwarf will collapse to a black hole.
At least
to a neutron star. No, it will not. Of course, I was fooling you a little bit by talking about negative pressure. Before the pressure turns negative, the pressure will become zero. And then everything stops. So we have, of course, perfect equilibrium if the total pressure is the one from Coulomb plus the one from Fermi gas, or from the, Fermi, is equal zero. Yeah, so eventually, we will reach the case where we have a stabilized object which is stable by itself. It doesn't need gravity to be stabilized. So basically, the Coulomb energy takes care of the Fermi pressure. So we have a Fermi pressure which is pushing outwards, and we have the lattice energy which is pulling inwards and holding everything together. And that's the reason why the pressure is negative. So it's holding stuff together. That makes the pressure negative. And the Fermi pressure pushes outwards, gives a positive sign. And at some instances, we have a balance of the lattice with the Fermi pressure. So we can compute the corresponding critical number density of electrons, and this turns out to be C squared alpha cubed over 2 pi to the third power times the mass of the electron to the third power. And this gives a mass density which is mu A over z squared alpha to the third power over 2 pi cubed times the mass of the electron cubed. And this is about, depending on which value you're taking for z, so if z is equal to 2 or 1 for hydrogen or helium, or if z is equal to 8 for oxygen, one gets value between 5 to 70 gram per cubic centimeters. This is for helium to oxygen. Again. Yeah. And 5.6, this is the average density of planet Earth. So here we are in the realm of planets. Yeah, planets are stabilized like Earth basically from a lattice, and if you so want the Fermi pressure, if it's a metal. For example, the core of Jupiter is a metal. There's in that case, of course, it's not helium, it's hydrogen in the core of Jupiter, which is a metal then, and could form then also a lattice. And that lattice would consist of protons on the side cell. We are not really talking about hydrogen white dwarfs. Hydrogen white dwarfs cannot be really formed in nature. Usually, even if we have low mass stars converting to a white dwarf, they usually burn hydrogen to helium. So there's always a helium core left. So white dwarfs always have a helium core, at least. And if they also turn on and burn helium to carbon and oxygen by the triple alpha process, like our sun, they will eventually turn to a carbon-oxygen white dwarf. Now, if you look at the lifetime of our sun has a lifetime of about 9 billion years, which is close to the age of the universe, which is 13 billion years. And if you look at the limiting mass for carbon burning for the triple alpha process, that limiting mass is around 0.4 solar masses. And do you know what is the lifetime of a 0.4 solar mass star? How does it go? Will it be longer lived or shorter lived?
Shorter. Higher mass means lower lifetime.
Higher mass means lower lifetime. More massive ones live shorter. So the less massive one with 0.4 solar masses lives longer. And what's the factor? How longer? How much longer? 1%, 10%, factor 10, factor 100.
Factor 1/2?
You don't know? So we had this table, right? When m is lower than around 0.4 solar masses, we have a helium white dwarf. Right, and everything below 8 solar masses makes the triple alpha process, but not more. So all the rest is basically carbon-oxygen white dwarfs. So helium white dwarfs can only form when the mass is below 0.4 solar masses. And the lifetime of those...
100 billion years?
Pardon me?
100 billion years?
100 billion years? No, not exactly. So the lifetime of a star... The lifetime of the star can be calculated by looking at the luminosity. And there's a law, an empirical law, called the luminosity-mass relation, empirically. So that the luminosity is proportional to the mass of the star to the power alpha. And alpha is about 3 to 4. 3.5, thereabout. It depends on the mass a little bit, if it's low mass or high mass. So, but just to get an order of magnitude estimate. Now, if you say that a star stops burning when it has converted 10% of the mass, so the lifetime T is then this is the energy per second, and now we divide the energy per second with 0.1 solar masses, basically. Yeah. Then this is proportional to the mass to the power of alpha minus 1. Yeah. Or say this is m to the beta, where beta is then about 2 to 3. Say 3 if you're on the high side. This means if you have half the mass of the star, then it's a half to the squared or to the cubed. So it lives 4 times longer or up to 8 times longer. So let's say this is 5 to 10 times longer. Than our sun. Yeah, so we have 10 billion years, so we are talking about 50 to 100 billion years. So you were right, actually. It's actually that much. So this means those stars, even if they form right at a Big Bang, were not able to form a helium white dwarf yet. So basically, all the white dwarfs we observe are carbon-oxygen white dwarfs. Helium white dwarfs have not been observed yet. And the cut is around 0.4 or maybe 0.5 solar masses, thereabout. So that's the reason also why most of the white dwarfs we see are between 0.5 solar masses and about 1 solar masses. The 1 solar mass comes from the Chandrasekhar limiting mass. But if you do a detailed calculation, so take a Fermi gas plus a Coulomb lattice, you take really the full polytropic equation. You don't take a polytropic equation of state, but really a full Fermi gas. You come up with a maximum mass, which is around 1 solar mass, maybe 1.1 at maximum, 1.2 solar masses. So all the white dwarfs are between 0.5 to 1.1, 1.2 solar masses. There have been some measurements also for white dwarfs with a mass below 0.5 solar masses, but the explanation is that those white dwarfs were stripped off by material by some encounters with other stars, by accretion or by collisions, stripped off the mass, so they become lower in mass. So that's also the reason why when plotting mass radius relation of white dwarfs, one usually constrains oneself to white dwarf masses above 0.5 solar masses. Yeah. So any questions to white dwarfs? Corrections to the Coulomb lattice? Now, we also know what's going to happen if the pressure is zero all the time, and we don't need gravity to balance the hydrostatic equilibrium. We know that the mass goes. M over R cubed is constant, right? We have the same mass radius relation as for quark stars. So basically, when we look at the mass radius relation, we have the maximum mass, and it will go down and eventually try to reach the shape of a 5/3 polytrope, but then we'll bend over and will turn into the mass radius relation for planets eventually. Good. So let's have a 5-minute break, and then we continue our lecture. So let's talk a little bit about how to determine the mass and the radius of a white dwarf. So it actually turns out to be not so easy. We know lots of white dwarfs are within our galaxy at the order of billions, a similar number as for neutron stars must be around, if not more, on white dwarfs. However, they have to be close by, and we need somehow to see them also shine. So after a few billion years, the temperature, the surface temperature, is so low that we can't observe them anymore. So what can we measure? Measure luminosity. We can measure the luminosity. L. We can measure the surface temperature. L is just measure the luminosity of the star, count energy per second, that's the luminosity, that's not too difficult. The surface temperature, we need to have a spectral, the spectrum of the star, and then say, okay, the maximum is there, and then we do a fit, a Planck curve fits through the spectrum, it more or less works, modular absorption, corrections from absorption and emission, and then we get some effective surface temperature. So let's write down here effective surface temperature. And it's the same meaning as for our sun. Also, our sun has a wiggle spectrum because of absorption lines, emission lines, but we can do a fit through it, a Planck curve fit, and then say, okay, the fit parameter is the temperature, the effective surface temperature of our sun, and then we get out 5,700 Kelvin, thereabout. And the same we can do for white dwarfs. We also need actually to really measure the radius, we need a distance to the star. Distance to white dwarf, which we denote as a d. Distance d. And in many cases, we can measure actually the redshift, the gravitation redshift. Redshift set. And that we measure usually from hydrogen lines. Balmer line, which we see that the Balmer line is has a redshift. And from that, we can infer then the gravitational redshift on the surface of a star. So most of the white dwarfs, of course, have an outer layer which is not helium but is hydrogen, either just by the fact that they are born by a star. So there's a helium core and outer layer of hydrogen, and a helium core collapses, and eventually there will be also a small layer of hydrogen left over from the fallback of the material, or the white dwarf is an accreting system, and then it accretes mainly hydrogen from the neighboring star, so there will always be some hydrogen around. And there's hydrogen floating around in our galaxy. There are hydrogen clouds, for example. So hydrogen is abundantly there. So if one measures the redshift, then actually turns out not from helium, but from hydrogen lines. Now, this works actually to look at the radius of a white dwarf, because we have the luminosity law, which we know from stellar evolution. The total luminosity is given. We say, of course, we have a surface temperature, so we assume we have a black body emitter. So the black body emitter is a pi squared over 30 to the temperature to 4 power. So this is a black body. Yeah. That's the fit to the spectrum. And we have to integrate over the whole surface of the star, 4 pi r squared. And if you work out the numbers, it actually turns out to really be the energy emitted per second, right? So we have the total energy of the star given by the temperature to the fourth power. But this is only the flux. And then we have to integrate over a sphere. And that's 4 pi r squared emitted from the surface of the star. And then we can calculate, okay, what's the flux we see on Earth?
So D we get actually from parallax measurements. That means that white dwarf has to be close by, stay within a few kiloparsecs to do a parallax measurement. So flux on Earth, this is really what we measure, and the flux on Earth is the energy per second per unit area which we measure, or per area. And the flux on Earth, the flux goes like r squared, or like 1 over r squared. So this goes like this factor here. Here we have an r squared. If we directly measure on the surface of the white dwarf, and here on Earth we have the distance d squared, and the flux of the white dwarf. And the gravitational redshift, this was the compactness of the star. 1 plus z is just the compactness of the star. Or in other terms, when one measures the delta lambda or the lambda, this is just given by gm over r. Yeah, and this was equal 1 plus z, the redshift. Okay. So this we get from here. This we get from parallax. This we measure, so we have a measure of the radius, in fact, right? If it's a black body emitter. We get a second, and from this, from the redshift, we get the mass, the compactness, so we can measure both. So in the ideal case, with these two measurements alone, measure the flux on Earth, the temperature, the distance, and the redshift, you get the mass and the radius. That's a simple case. We can also infer the mass by looking, if we have a binary system, for example, and if that white dwarf is orbiting an ordinary star, and from stellar evolution we can infer the mass of the star. And then using just Kepler's law, we can then just measure from the movement of the white dwarf, we can measure then the mass of the white dwarf. Yeah. And then actually this turns out to be similar for exoplanet studies. So if you want to measure the mass and the radius of exoplanets, one does similar things. So if one measures the mass of an exoplanet, one looks at the wobbling of spectral lines within a star. So in principle, also from wobbling spectral lines, if there's a companion white dwarf around an ordinary star, one can infer then also the mass of the white dwarf. And if the white dwarf is going passing in front of a star, the luminosity curve of the star will go down and will go up again. And from how much it goes down, we can infer the effective surface of the white dwarf, which is blocking out the light from the star. So we get a radius measurement. So that would be an alternative for binary systems. Binary systems, M from Kepler's law, for known M sun, M star, or M companion.
be an alternative. Yeah, and for exoplanets, this has been very successful. Yeah, for exoplanets, we can determine masses which are down to Earth masses, to Jupiter masses, so very, very precisely. We can determine also the radii down to the sizes of Earth or of Jupiter, and those radii are actually similar as for a white dwarf. Also for a white dwarf, we have 10,000 kilometers, so this is planet-like objects, so we can really see them. All right. Of course, for exoplanets, they are not as hot as white dwarfs. So white dwarfs are usually hot, so white dwarfs have 10 to 50,000 Kelvin. So they're very bright, so we can really observe directly the luminosity of white dwarfs. For exoplanets, it's hopeless. We have maybe 1,000 Kelvin, a few thousand Kelvin maximum effective surface temperature, so the luminosity is very low and it's very hard to see them directly. Good, so this was a small excursion into how to measure the mass and the radius of white dwarfs. And that's actually also how one gets then the values for Sirius B I have given to you of the mass and the radius of Sirius A in the very beginning of our lecture. Good. Okay. Any questions to mass radius measurements? Pardon me?
Would we notice from just observing an eclipsing system if it's a full eclipse or a partial eclipse?
So the question was if for eclipsing system, if you are really sure that it is a full eclipse, not a partial eclipse. So ordinarily, if we have a star and then the white dwarf is moving across like this, then of course the luminosity L as a function of time will go down like this. Or if it is partially eclipsing, right? So it would go like this. Then it would also drop, but we would infer then only a smaller. So what we need to know in addition is actually also from Kepler's law, we need the angle sine I. We need to determine that angle. If we have binary systems, we need actually two more information. So one information would be the mass of the star. The other one would be the orientation of the plane. So if it is either like that or if it is like that. So how does this go for exoplanets? Do you recall how this goes for exoplanets, for the sign I? So one can infer, actually, one can get this angle by looking at the shape of how the spectral lines shift within the sun, within the star. So if you look at the wobbling and it is perfectly like that, you get a perfect sinusoidal curve of the spectral line, how it is changing. If the plane is a little bit off, it will change a little bit. Also, if there's some ellipticity, it will change a little bit. So from the slope of the how the spectral line, the wobbling of the spectral line goes with time, one can infer actually that angle. And then one can be sure that it is either fully eclipsed or not, a posteriori. Yeah, that's right. You can use two methods to determine the radius and check if it is compatible with each other.
But most of the time, I guess the star at the white dwarf is orbiting is much more luminous than the white dwarf itself. You might not be able to tell just from measuring the luminosity if you actually see the white dwarf.
So you have to block the light from the star and just measure the luminosity coming from Sirius B. And that can be a problem, of course. So it has been a problem for Sirius B. So there was actually, when Adams made first measurement of Sirius B, the properties of the radius and the mass of Sirius B, he did a wrong measurement. So he got out a wrong radius because he didn't really block out effectively the starlight. The star was also shining onto the white dwarf, and this was reflecting from the starlight. And one has to subtract that, actually, and that turns out to be rather difficult. So he got a wrong radius. And there was a long dispute between Chandrasekhar and Eddington about this issue. So Eddington said, you cannot explain the mass and the radius of Sirius B within your model because of the wrong radius measurement. So there was a long battle that Eddington said that the theory of Chandrasekhar is wrong and it cannot collapse to a black hole and there's something else is happening before it gets to the maximum mass. And later on they did a correct measurement and it was bang on the theory of Chandrasekhar. Maybe I should write down the numbers. I gave you the numbers of the mass of Sirius A, right, before. So I have one value here for Sirius B. So M is one solar mass plus minus 0.016 solar masses. The radius is 0.0084 plus minus 0.0002, the radius of the sun, and the effective temperature is something like 24,700 plus minus 300 Kelvin. So those numbers changed a little bit in the last years, but more or less reflect the actual numbers, and also the error bars are about that order. So quite precise measurements in particular for the radius. Later on we will discuss mass radius measurements for neutron stars, which will turn out to be different. So one of the basic principles we discussed here will remain, but unfortunately we will see there will be no redshift measurements for neutron stars. That will be a problem. But we had other advantages for measuring the mass of the neutron star, which comes from corrections from general relativity. Good. Any questions? One more correction about mass radius measurements of white dwarfs. It turns out if they plot a mass radius relation, they plot it in another way. So they plot the radius mass curve is usually plotted for white dwarfs. And then it turns out to be a curve like this to the Chandrasekhar limiting mass. And the data points are here. But actually, you also find data points here, and many of them. By looking at Sloan Digital Sky Survey data, SDSS data, or soon there is also will be some data from Gaia and Hipparchos. And they measure also the spectrum, so they can measure the redshift and the flux. And by parallax measurement, we know then also approximately the mass and the radius. So why does it go like this? And the reason is the high temperature here. We have 10,000s of Kelvin, so it turns out that the outer layer is bloated up. So this is temperature effect here. T bloats up the white dwarf. So R increases due to the high temperature. And this is what one sees here. So one can do models which take into account this effective temperature. So in principle, onto the top of the outer layers, if you calculate the equation of state, you have to add the equation of state for the ideal gas law, P is N times T, and then just add this. So this is the bloated up atmosphere of a white dwarf. That's why one sees those large radius. Right? And then you see actually then if you do this curve that these curves here, this one here is for T equals zero, and these curves are for T larger than zero, these curves here. And then it fits again. Yeah, and this is about one solar mass. So Sirius is actually very close here to the maximum mass, so somewhere here. Right, and the radius here is about 10,000 kilometers. There about 5,000 to 10,000 kilometers. This is about the value. This is a linear plot, by the way. Good. So, I think we have only a few minutes left. Yeah, I don't want to start a new chapter. Maybe just a quick remark before we close the lecture for today. There are corrections at high densities. There is a scale where we have so-called pycnonuclear reactions. I just mentioned that. Means basically fire. Right? So there are reactions where we have fusion reactions. These are fusion reactions, nuclear fusion, by tunneling. Yeah, so there are all these nuclei sitting on lattice cells. Now it can happen that actually that there's still a quantum mechanical wave function which extends also to the other wave function here, that these two nuclei can suddenly make fusion and form heavier elements, and thereby change the composition of a white dwarf, and thereby also forming a source for heat for white dwarfs. What we haven't discussed actually is that there's also a critical temperature for a lattice to melt. So if we look at the structure of a white dwarf, we have then also here we have the atmospheric layer, which can be quite large due to the high temperature. So this would be the hydrogen layer. And there is no lattice because the lattice melts, and the lattice can melt up to a certain depth. lattice melts. So here we have basically what is called then an ocean. Yeah, here we have the atmosphere. Basically, we have really hydrogen atoms, atmosphere, so these are atoms. Here we have then a structure where we have nuclei plus electrons. So we really have a plasma, like a Fermi gas. Here we have an ideal gas law. And then in the interior here, then we really have a lattice here. Nuclei plus electrons. And then in the core, in the very core, we can have then heavier elements by pyknonuclear reactions. What are most massive white dwarfs? The other corrections we have are magnetic field and rotation. And it turns out that the effect of the magnetic field that the energy density we have in a magnetic field, which is proportional to the magnetic field squared, this turns out to be much, much smaller than any other scale we have in the system, even Coulomb or the Fermi energy, for the observed values we have. So we need, let's say it in other words, that the binding, that the energy we have in magnetic field is of the same order as the other ones, as Coulomb or the Fermi one, only for the magnetic field at the order of 10 to 12 Gauss. And this has not been observed for white dwarfs, at least for white dwarfs. For white dwarfs, we're talking about 10 to 6, maybe 10 to 9 Gauss, but not 10 to 12 Gauss. Had not been observed. Yeah. So this will have no effect on the maximum mass of white dwarfs because the magnetic field observed is too small. It will have an effect on the structure of the lattice. It will deform a little bit the composition. It will deform the atoms, so the atoms will now be stretched. If the magnetic field is at the order of 10 to 6, 10 to 9 Gauss, we have energies which are in a similar ballpark as the binding energy of electrons of hydrogen. Then the hydrogen atoms will be really stretched along the magnetic fields. And the other thing is effect of rotation. This can be quite massive, so the maximum mass increases by, how do we say this? So we have W is kinetic energy. This can actually increase the maximum mass. Substantially. It substantially means by 20%, at least 20%, and if it's differential rotation, rotating even more. This means if it is rotating at the maximum rotation frequency, then it will increase the maximum mass by 20%. Good. Any questions to this? If not, then I will close the lecture and we reconvene then on Thursday.